his fellow warriors had reached the camp. She roused herself. As he had before, Blodgarm half sang, half whispered a spell that created an insubstantial likeness of Aragorn, which the elf caused to walk out of the tent and climb onto Saphira's back, where it sat looking around in a perfect imitation of independent life. Visually the apparition was flawless, but it had no mind of its own, and if any of Galbatorix's agents tried to eavesdrop upon Aragorn's thoughts, they would discover the deceit forthwith. Therefore the success of the ploy depended upon Saphira ferrying the apparition through the camp and out of sight as quickly as possible, and upon the hope that Aragorn's reputation was so formidable, it would discourage clandestine observers from attempting to glean information about the Varden from his consciousness for fear of his vengeance. Saphira started up and bounded through the camp, the 12 elves running in formation around her. Men leaped out of their path, shouting, "Hail Shadeslayer!" and "Hail Saphira!" which kindled a warm glow in her belly. When she arrived at Nasawada's folded wing red butterfly chrysalis tent, she crouched and stuck her head inside the dark gap along one wall, where Nasawada's guards had pulled aside a panel of fabric to allow her access. Blodgarm resumed his soft singing then, and the Aragorn wraith climbed down off Saphira, entered the crimson tent, and once it was out of sight of the gawking onlookers outside, dissolved into nothingness.
"Do you think our ruse was discovered?"
Nasawada asked from her high-backed chair. Blodgarm bowed with an elegant gesture.
"Again, Lady Nasawada, I cannot say for sure. We will have to wait and see if the Empire moves to take advantage of Aragorn's absence before we will know the answer to that question."
"Thank you, Blodgarm. That will be all."
With another bow, the elf withdrew from the tent and took up a position several yards behind Saphira, guarding her flank. Saphira settled down onto her underside and began to lick clean the scales around the third claw on her left forefoot, between which there had accumulated unsightly lines of the dry white clay she remembered standing in when she ate her last kill. Not a minute later, Martland Redbeard, Roran, and a man with round ears, whom she did not recognize, entered the red tent and bowed to Nasawada. Saphira paused in her cleaning to taste the air with her tongue, and discerned the tang of dried blood, the bitter sour musk of sweat, the scent of horse and leather intermingled, and, faint but unmistakable, the sharp spike of man fear. She examined the trio again, and saw that the red long-beard man had lost his right hand, then returned to excavating the clay from around her scales. She continued licking her foot, restoring every scale to pristine brilliance, while first Martland, then the man with round ears who was Ulhart, then Roran, told a tale of blood and fire and of laughing men who refused to die at their allotted times but insisted upon continuing to fight long past when Angvard had called their names. As was her wont, Saphira held her peace, while others, specifically Nasawada and her adviser, long man gaunt-faced Jormunda, questioned the warriors about the details of their ill-fated mission. Saphira knew it sometimes puzzled Aragorn why she did not participate more in conversations. Her reasons for silence were simple. Save for Arya or Gleda, she felt most comfortable communicating only with Aragorn, and in her opinion most conversations were nothing more than pointless dithering. Whether round ear, pointed ear, horned or short, two legs seemed addicted to dithering. Brom had not dithered, which was something Saphira had liked about him. For her, choices were simple. Either there was an action she could take to improve the situation, in which case she took it, or there was not. And everything else said on the subject was so much meaningless noise. In any event, she did not worry herself about the future, except where Aragorn was concerned. Him she always worried about. When the questions were finished, Nasawada expressed her condolences to Martland for his lost hand, then dismissed Martland and Ulhart, but not Roran, to whom she said,
"You have demonstrated your prowess once again, Stronghammer. I am well pleased with your abilities."
Thank you, my lady.
Our best healers will attend to him, but Martland will still need time to recover from his injury. Even once he does, he cannot lead raids such as these with only one hand. From now on, he will have to serve the Varden from the back of the army, not the front. I think, perhaps, that I shall promote him and make him one of my battle advisers. Jormungandr, what think you of that idea?
I think it an excellent idea, my lady.
Nasawada nodded, appearing satisfied.
This means, however, that I must find another captain for you to serve under, Roran.
Then Roran said,
My lady, what of my own command? Have I not proven myself to your satisfaction with these two raids, as well as with my past accomplishments?
If you continue to distinguish yourself as you have, Stronghammer, you will win your command soon enough. However, you must be patient and abide a while longer. Two missions alone, however impressive, may not reveal the full scope of a man's character. I am a cautious person when it comes to entrusting my people to others, Stronghammer. In this, you must humour me.
Roran gripped the head of the hammer stuck through his belt, veins and tendons standing out on his hand, but his tone remained polite.
Of course, Lady Nesawada.
Very good. A page will bring you your new assignment later today. Oh, and see to it that you have a large meal, once you and Katrina finish celebrating your reunion. That's an order, Stronghammer. You look as if you're about to fall over.
My lady. As Roran started to leave, Nasawada raised a hand and said,
Roran?
He paused.
Now that you have fought these men who feel no pain, do you believe that having similar protection from the agonies of the flesh would make it easier to defeat them?
Roran hesitated, then shook his head.
Their strength is their weakness. They do not shield themselves as they would if they feared the bite of a sword or the stab of an arrow, and thus they are careless with their lives. It is true they can continue fighting long past when an ordinary man would have dropped dead, and that is no small advantage in battle. But they also die in greater numbers because they do not protect their bodies as they ought. In their numb confidence, they will walk into traps and peril we would go to great lengths to avoid. As long as the Varden spirits remain high, I believe that with the right tactics, we can prevail against these laughing monsters. If we were like them, though, we would hack each other into oblivion, and neither of us would care, since we would have no thought for self-preservation. Those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Roran.
When Roran had gone, Saphira said,
Nothing yet from Aragorn?
Nasawada shook her head.
No, nothing yet from him, and his silence is beginning to concern me. If he has not contacted us by the day after tomorrow, I will have Arya send a message to one of Auric's spellcasters, demanding a report from him. If Aragorn is unable to hasten the end of the dwarfs' clanmeet, then I fear we will no longer be able to count on the dwarves as allies during the battles to come. The only good of such a disastrous outcome would be that Aragorn could return to us without further delay.
When Saphira was ready to leave the red chrysalis tent, Blodgarm again summoned up the apparition of Aragorn and placed it on Saphira's back. Then Saphira withdrew her head from the confines of the tent, and as she had before, bounded through the camp, the lithe elves keeping step with her the entire way. Once she reached Aragorn's tent, and the coloured shadow Aragorn disappeared inside it, Saphira lowered herself to the ground and resigned herself to waiting out the remainder of the day in unrelieved monotony. Before she resumed her reluctant nap, however, she extended her mind toward Roran and Katrina's tent and pressed against Roran's mind until he lowered the barriers around his consciousness.
Saphira?
He asked.
Do you know another such as me?
Of course not. You just surprised me. I am, somewhat occupied at the moment.
She studied the color of his emotions as well as those of Katrina, and was amused by her findings.
I only wished to welcome you back. I'm glad you were not injured.
Roran's thoughts flashed quick, hot, muddled cold, and he seemed to have difficulty forming a coherent answer. Eventually he said, "That's very kind of you, Saphira."
"If you can, come visit me tomorrow, when we may speak at greater length. I grow restless sitting here day after day. Perhaps you could tell me more about how Aragorn was before I hatched for him."
It would be my honor." Satisfied she had fulfilled the demands of Round Ear's two legs courtesy by welcoming Roran, and heartened by the knowledge that the following day would not be as boring, for it was unthinkable anyone would dare ignore her request for an audience, Saphira made herself as comfortable as she could on the bare earth, wishing, as she often did, for the soft nest that was hers in Aragorn's wind-rocked treehouse in Ellesmere. A puff of smoke escaped her as she sighed and fell asleep, and dreamed that she flew higher than she ever had before. She flapped and she flapped until she rose above the unreachable peaks of the Beor Mountains. There she circled for a time, gazing down at the whole of Alagaesia laid out before her. Then an uncontrollable desire entered her to climb even higher and see what she might. And so she began flapping again, and in what seemed like the blink of an eye, she soared past the glaring moon, until only she and the silver stars hung in the black sky. She drifted among the heavens for an indeterminate period, queen of the bright, jewel-like world below. But then disquiet entered her soul, and she cried out with her thoughts,
"Aragorn, where are you?"
"Kiss me, sweet." Waking, Roran extricated himself from Katrina's smooth arms and sat bare-chested on the edge of the cot they shared. He yawned and rubbed his eyes, then gazed at the pale strip of firelight that glowed between the two entrance flaps, feeling dull and stupid with accumulated exhaustion. A chill crept over him, but he remained where he was, motionless.
"Roran?"
Katrina asked, in a sleep-smeared voice. She propped herself up on one arm and reached for him with the other. He did not react as she touched him, sliding her hand across his upper back and rubbing his neck.
"Sleep. You need your rest. You'll be gone again before long."
He shook his head, not looking at her.
"What is it?" she asked.
Sitting upright, she pulled a blanket over his shoulders, then leaned against him, her cheek warm against his arm.
"Are you worried about your new captain, or where Nasawada may send you next?"
"No." She was silent for a while.
"Every time you leave, I feel as if less of you returns to me. You have become so grim and quiet. If you want to tell me about what is troubling you, you can, you know, no matter how terrible it is. I am the daughter of a butcher, and I've seen my share of men fall in battle."
"Want," Roran exclaimed, choking on the word. "I don't ever want to think about it again." He clenched his fists, his breathing uncertain. "A true warrior would not feel as I do."
"A true warrior," she said, "does not fight because he wishes to, but because he has to. A man who yearns for war, a man who enjoys his killing, he is a brute and a monster. No matter how much glory he wins on the battlefield, that cannot erase the fact that he is no better than a rabid wolf who will turn on his friends and family as soon as his foes." She brushed his hair away from his brow and stroked the top of his head, light and slow. "You once told me that the Song of Geraint was your favorite of Brom's stories, that it was why you fight with a hammer instead of a blade. Remember how Geraint disliked killing, and how reluctant he was to take up arms again?"
"Aye."
"And yet he was considered the greatest warrior of his age."
She cupped his cheek in her hand and turned his face toward her so that he was forced to gaze into her solemn eyes.
"And you are the greatest warrior I know of, Roran, here or anywhere."
With a dry mouth he said,
What of Aragorn, or...
They are not half so valorous as you. Aragorn, Murtagh, Galbatorix, the elves, all of them march into battle with spells upon their lips and might that far exceeds ours. But you, she kissed him on the nose, you are no more than a man. You face your foes on your own 2 feet. You are not a magician, and yet you slew the twins. You are only as fast and as strong as a human may be, and yet you did not shirk from attacking the Razak in their lair and freeing me from their dungeon.
He swallowed. I had wards from Aragorn to protect me.
But no longer. Besides, you did not have any wards in Carverhall either. And did you flee from the Razak then?
When he was unresponsive, she said,
You are no more than a man, but you have done things not even Aragorn or Murtagh could have. To me, that makes you the greatest warrior in Alagaesia. I cannot think of anyone else in Carverhall who would have gone to the lengths you did to rescue me.
Your father would have, he said. He felt her shiver against him.
Yes, he would have, she whispered. But he never would have been able to convince others to follow him as you did.
She tightened her arm around him.
Whatever you have seen or done, you will always have me. That is all I will ever need, he said, and clasped her in his arms and held her for a span.
Then he sighed. Still, I wish this war were at an end. I wish I could till a field again and sow my crops and harvest them when they ripened. Farming is back-breaking work, but at least it is honest labor. This killing isn't honest. It is thievery. The thievery of men's lives, and no right-minded person should aspire to it.
As I said.
As you said. Difficult as it was, he made himself smile. I have forgotten myself. Here I am, burdening you with my troubles, when you have worries enough of your own. And he placed a hand over her rounding womb.
Your troubles shall always be my troubles, so long as we are married, she murmured, and nuzzled his arm.
Some troubles, he said, no one else should have to endure, especially not those you love. She withdrew an inch or two from him, and he saw her eyes become bleak and listless, as they did whenever she felt to brooding over the time she had spent imprisoned in Helgrind.
No, she whispered. Some troubles no one else should have to endure. Oh, do not be sad.
He pulled her closer and rocked back and forth with her, and wished with all his might that Aragorn had not found Saphira's egg in the spine. After a while, when Katrina had grown soft in his arms again, and even he no longer felt quite so tense, he caressed the curve of her neck.
Come, kiss me, sweet, and then let us return to bed, for I am tired and I would sleep.
She laughed at him then, and kissed him most sweetly, and then they lay upon the cot as they had before, and outside the tent all was still and quiet, except for the Jeet River, which flowed past the camp, never pausing, never stopping, and poured itself into Roran's dreams, where he imagined himself standing at the prow of a ship, Katrina by his side, and gazing into the maw of the giant whirlpool, the boar's eye. And he thought, how can we hope to escape? Glumra. Hundreds of feet below Trondheim, the stone opened up into a cavern thousands of feet long, with a still black lake of unknown depth along one side, and a marble shore on the other. Brown and ivory stalactites dripped from the ceiling, while stalagmites stabbed upward from the ground, and in places the two joined, to form bulging pillars thicker around than even the largest trees in Duweldenvarden. Scattered among the pillars were mounds of compost, studded with mushrooms, as well as 23 low stone huts. A flameless lantern glowed iron-red next to each of their doors. Beyond the reach of the lanterns, shadows abounded. Inside one of the huts, Aragorn sat in a chair that was too small for him,
at a granite table no higher than his knees. The smell of soft goat cheese, sliced mushrooms, yeast, stew, pigeon eggs, and coal dust pervaded the air. Across from him, Glumra, a dwarf woman of the family of Mord, she who was the mother of Kvaistor, Aragorn's slain guard, wailed and tore at her hair and beat at her breast with her fists. Glistening tracks marked where her tears had rolled down her plump face. The two of them were alone in the hut. Aragorn's four guards, their numbers replenished by Thrand, a warrior from Oryk's retinue, were waiting outside, along with Hundfast, Aragorn's translator, whom Aragorn had dismissed from the hut once he learned that Glumra could speak his language. After the attempt on his life, Aragorn had contacted Oryk with his mind, whereupon Oryk insisted Aragorn run as fast as he could to the chambers of the Injitum, where he would be safe from any more assassins. Aragorn had obeyed, and there he had remained while Oryk forced the clanmeet to adjourn until the following morning, on the grounds that an emergency had arisen within his clan that required his immediate attention. Then Oryk marched with his stoutest warriors and most adept spellcaster to the site of the ambush, which they studied and recorded with means both magical and mundane. Once Oryk was satisfied they had learned all they could, he had hurried back to his chambers, where he said to Aragorn,
"We have much to do, and little time in which to do it. Before the clan meet resumes upon the third morning hour of tomorrow, we must attempt to establish beyond all doubt who ordered the attack. If we can, then we will have leverage to use against them. If not, then we will be flailing in the dark, uncertain of our enemies. We can keep the attack a secret until the clan meet, but no longer. Nurlan will have heard echoes of your fight throughout the tunnels under Tronchin, and even now I know they will be searching for the source of the disturbance, for fear there may have been a cave-in or similar catastrophe that might undermine the city above."
Oryk stamped his feet and cursed the ancestors of whoever had sent the assassins, then planted his fists on his hips and said,
"A clan war was already threatening us, but now it stands upon our very threshold. We must move quickly if we are to avert that dread fate. There are Nurlan to find, questions to ask, threats to make, bribes to offer, and scrolls to steal, and all before morn."
"What of me?" Aragorn asked.
"You should remain here until we know if Azsweldon Rac-Anuin or some other clan has a larger force massed elsewhere to kill you. Also, as long as we can hide from your attackers, whether you are alive, dead, or wounded, the longer we may keep them uncertain as to the safety of the rock beneath their feet."
At first Aragorn agreed with Oryk's proposal, but as he watched the dwarf bustle about issuing orders, he felt increasingly uneasy and helpless. Finally he caught Oryk by the arm and said, "If I have to sit here and stare at the wall while you search for the villains who did this, I'll grind my teeth down to nubs. There must be something I can do to help. What of Kvaistor? Do any of his family live in Trondheim? Has anyone told them of his death yet? Because if not, I would be the one to bring them the tidings, for it was me he died defending." Oryk inquired of his guards, and from them they learnt that Kvaistor did indeed have family in Trondheim, or more accurately, underneath Trondheim. When he heard, Oryk frowned and muttered a strange word in Dwarvish.
"They are deep dwellers," he said. "Nurlan who have forsaken the surface of the land for the world below, except for occasional forays above. More of them live here below Trondheim and Farthendur than anywhere else, because they can come out in Farthendur, and not feel as if they are actually outside, which most of them cannot bear. They are so accustomed to closed-in spaces. I had not known Kvaistor was of their number."
"Would you mind if I go to visit his family?" Aragorn asked. "Among these rooms there are stairs that lead below, am I right? We could leave without anyone being the wiser."
Oryk thought for a moment, then nodded.
"You're right. The path is safe enough, and no one would think to look for you among the deep dwellers. They would come here first,
and here they would otherwise find you. Go, and do not return until I send a messenger for you, even if the family of Maud turns you away, and you must sit on a stalagmite until morn. But, Aragorn, be you careful. The deep dwellers keep to themselves for the most part, and they are prickly to an extreme about their honour, and they have strange customs of their own. Tread carefully, as if you were on rotten shale, eh?
And so, with Thrand added to his guards, and Hundfast accompanying them, and with a short dwarf sword belted around his waist, Aragorn went to the nearest staircase leading downward, and following it, he descended farther into the bowels of the earth than ever he had before. And in due time he found Glumra, and informed her of Kvaista's demise, and now he sat listening as she grieved for her slain child, alternating between wordless howls and scraps of dwarvish sung in a haunting, dissonant key. Discomfited by the strength of her sorrow, Aragorn glanced away from her face. He looked at the green soapstone stove that stood against one wall, and the worn carvings of geometric design that adorned its edges. He studied the green and brown rug that lay before the hearth, and the churn in the corner, and the provisions hanging from the beams of the ceiling. He gazed at the heavy timbered loom that stood underneath a round window with panes of lavender glass. Then at the height of her wailing, Glumra caught Aragorn's eye as she rose from the table, went to the counter, and placed her left hand on the cutting board. Before Aragorn could stop her, she took a carving knife and cut off the first joint of her little finger. She groaned and doubled over. Aragorn sprang halfway up with an involuntary exclamation. He wondered what madness had overcome the dwarf woman, and whether he should attempt to restrain her, lest she should do herself additional harm. He opened his mouth to ask if she wanted him to heal the wound, but then he thought better of it, remembering Oryk's admonishments about the deep dweller's strange customs and strong sense of honour. She might consider the offer an insult, he realized. Closing his mouth, he sank back into his too small chair. After a minute, Glumra straightened out of her hunched position, took a deep breath, and then quietly and calmly washed the raw end of her finger with brandy, smeared it with a yellow salve, and bandaged the wound. Her moon face still pale from the shock, she lowered herself into the chair opposite Aragorn.
I thank you, Shadeslayer, for bringing me news of mine son's fate yourself. I am glad to know that he died proudly, as a warrior ought to.
He was most brave, Aragorn said. He could see that our enemies were as fast as elves, and yet he still leaped forward to protect me. His sacrifice bought me time to escape their blades, and also revealed the danger of the enchantments they had placed on their weapons. If not for his actions, I doubt I would be here now. Glumra nodded slowly, eyes downcast, and smoothed the front of her dress.
Do you know who was responsible for this attack on our clan, Shadeslayer?
We have only suspicions.
Grimst Borith Oryk is trying to determine the truth of the matter even as we speak. Was it Aswaldan Rak Anuin?
Glumra asked, surprising Aragorn with the astuteness of her guest. He did his best to conceal his reaction. When he remained silent, she said,
We all know of their blood feud with you, Arjutlam. Every Nurla within these mountains knows. Some of us have looked with favour upon their opposition of you. But if they thought to actually kill you, then they have misjudged the lay of the rock and doomed themselves because of it.
Aragorn raised an eyebrow, interested.
Doomed? How? It was you, Shadeslayer, who slew Durza, and so allowed us to save Trondheim and the dwellings below from the clutches of Galbatorix. Our race shall never forget that, so long as Trondheim remains standing. And then there is word come by the tunnels that your dragon shall make whole again Isidar Mithrim.
Aragorn nodded.
That is good of you, Shadeslayer. You have done much for our race, and whichever clan it was attacked you, we shall turn against them and have our vengeance.
I swore before witnesses, Aragorn said, and I swear to you as well that I will punish whoever sent those backstabbing murderers and that I'll make them wish they had never thought of such a foul deed. However, thank you, Shadeslayer.
Aragorn hesitated, then inclined his head.
However, we must not do anything that would ignite a clan war. Not now. If force is to be used, it should be Grimes Borith Oric who decides when and where we draw our swords. Don't you agree? I will think upon what you have said, Shadeslayer,
Glumra replied.
Oric is...
Whatever she was going to say next caught in her mouth. Her thick eyelids drooped, and she sagged forward for a moment, pressing her maimed hand against her abdomen. When the bout passed, she pushed herself upright and held the back of the hand against her opposite cheek and swayed from side to side, moaning,
"Oh, mine son! Mine beautiful son!"
Standing, she staggered around the table, heading toward a small collection of swords and axes mounted on the wall behind Aragorn, next to an alcove covered by a curtain of red silk. Afraid that she intended to cause herself further injury, Aragorn leaped to his feet, knocking over the oak chair in his haste. He reached for her, and then saw that she was walking toward the curtained alcove, not the weapons, and he snatched his arm back before he caused offence. The brass rings sewn on top of the silk drapery clattered against one another as Glumra swept aside the cloth, to expose a deep, shadowed shelf, carved with runes and shapes of such fantastic detail. Aragorn thought he could stare at them for hours and still not grasp them in their entirety. On the low shelf rested statues of the 6 major dwarf gods, as well as 9 other entities Aragorn was unfamiliar with, all carved with exaggerated features and postures to better convey the character of the being portrayed. Glumra removed an amulet of gold and silver from within her bodice, which she kissed and then held against the hollow of her throat, as she knelt before the alcove, her voice rising and falling in the strange patterns of dwarf music, she began to croon a dirge in her native language. The melody brought tears to Aragorn's eyes. For several minutes Glumra sang, and then she fell silent and continued to gaze at the figurines. And as she gazed, the lines of her grief-ravaged face softened. And where before Aragorn had perceived only anger, distress, and hopelessness, her countenance assumed an air of calm acceptance, of peacefulness, and of sublime transcendence. A soft glow seemed to emanate from her features. So complete was Glumra's transformation, Aragorn almost did not recognize her. She said, "Tonight, Quaestor will dine in Morgothol's hall. That I know." She kissed her amulet again.
"I wish I might break bread with him, along with mine husband, Bowden. But it is not mine time to sleep in the catacombs of Trondheim, and Morgothal refuses entry to his hall to those who quicken their arrival. But in time our family shall be reunited, including all of our ancestors since Gunterra created the world from darkness. That I know."
Aragorn knelt next to her, and in a hoarse voice he asked,
"How do you know this?" "I know because it is so."
Her movements slow and respectful, Glumra touched the chiseled feet of each of the gods with the tips of her fingers.
"How could it be otherwise? Since the world could not have created itself any more than a sword or a helm might. And since the only beings with the wherewithal to forge the earth and the heavens into shape are those with divine power, it is to the gods we must look for our answers. Them I trust to ensure the rightness of the world, and by mine trust I free myself of the burdens of mine flesh."
She spoke with such conviction, Aragorn felt a sudden desire to share in her belief.
He longed to toss aside his doubts and fears, and to know that however horrible the world might seem at times, life was not mere confusion. He wished to know for certain that who he was would not end if a sword should shear off his head, and that one day he would meet again with Brom, Garrow, and everyone else he had cared for and lost. A desperate yearning for hope and comfort filled him, confused him, left him unsteady upon the face of the earth. And yet, part of himself held back, and would not allow him to commit to the dwarf gods and bind his identity and his sense of well-being to something he did not understand. He also had difficulty accepting that if gods did exist, the dwarf gods were the only ones. Aragorn was certain that if he asked Nargajvarg or a member of the nomad tribes, or even the black priests of Helgrind, if their gods were real, they would uphold the supremacy of their deities just as vigorously as Glumra would uphold hers. How am I supposed to know which religion is the true religion? He wondered. Just because someone follows a certain faith does not necessarily mean it is the right path. Perhaps no one religion contains all of the truth of the world. Perhaps every religion contains fragments of the truth, and it is our responsibility to identify those fragments and piece them together. Or perhaps the elves are right, and there are no gods. But how can I know for sure? With a long sigh, Glumra murmured a phrase in Dwarvish, then rose from her knees and drew close the silk curtain over the alcove. Aragorn likewise stood, wincing as his battle-sore muscles stretched, and followed her to the table, where he returned to his chair. From a stone cupboard set into the wall, the dwarf woman took two pewter mugs, then retrieved a bladder full of wine from where it hung from the ceiling, and poured a drink for both her and Aragorn. She raised her mug and uttered a toast in Dwarvish, which Aragorn struggled to imitate, and then they drank. "It is good," said Glumra, "to know that Kvaistor still lives on, to know that even now he is garbed in robes fit for a king while he enjoys the evening feast in Morgothol's hall. May he win much honour in the service of the gods." And she drank again. Once he had emptied his mug, Aragorn began to bid farewell to Glumra, but she forestalled him with a motion of her hand. "Have you a place to stay, Shadeslayer, safe from those who wish you dead?" Whereupon Aragorn told her how he was supposed to remain hidden underneath Trondheim until Oric sent a messenger for him. Glumra nodded with a short, definitive jerk of her chin, and said, "Then you and your companions must wait here until the messenger arrives, Shadeslayer. I insist upon it." Aragorn started to protest, but she shook her head. "I could not allow the men who fought with mine son to languish in the damp and the dark of the caves while I yet have life in mine bones. Summon your companions, and we shall eat and be merry this gloomy night." Aragorn realized that he could not leave without upsetting Glumra, so he called to his guards and his translator. Together they helped Glumra to prepare a dinner of bread, meat, and pie. And when it was ready, the lot of them ate and drank and talked late into the night. Glumra was particularly lively. She drank the most, laughed the loudest, and was always the first to make a witty remark. At first Aragorn was shocked by her behaviour, but then he noticed how her smiles never reached her eyes, and how, if she thought no one was looking, the mirth would drain from her face, and her expression would become one of sombre quietude. Entertaining them, he concluded, was her way of celebrating her son's memory, as well as fending off her grief at Kvaistor's death. "I have never met anyone like you before," he thought as he watched her. Long after midnight, someone knocked on the door of the hut. Unfast ushered in a dwarf who was garbed in full armour, and who seemed edgy and ill at ease. He kept glancing at the doors and windows and shadowed corners. With a series of phrases in the ancient language, he convinced Aragorn that he was Oric's messenger, and then he said,
"I am Farn, son of Flossi, Arjitlam. Oric bids you return with all possible haste. He has most important tidings concerning the events of today."
At the doorway, Glumra grasped Aragorn's left forearm with fingers like steel,
and as he gazed down into her flinty eyes, she said, "Remember your oath, Shadeslayer, and do not let the killers of mine son escape without retribution." "That I shall not," he promised. Clan Meet. The dwarves, standing watch outside of Oryk's chambers, threw open the double doors that led inside as Aragorn strode toward them. The entryway beyond was long and ornate, furnished with three circular seats upholstered with red fabric, set in a line down the middle of the room. Embroidered hangings decorated the walls, along with the dwarves' ubiquitous flameless lanterns, while the ceiling had been carved to depict a famous battle from dwarven history. Oryk stood consulting with a group of his warriors and several grey-bearded dwarves of Durgrimstingetum. As Aragorn approached, Oryk turned toward him, his face grim.
"Good, you did not delay. Hunfast, you may retire to your quarters now. We must needs speak in private."
Aragorn's translator bowed and disappeared through an archway to the left, his footsteps echoing on the polished agate floor. Once he was out of hearing, Aragorn said, "You don't trust him?" Oryk shrugged.
"I do not know whom to trust at the moment. The fewer people who know what we have discovered, the better. We cannot risk the news escaping to another clan before tomorrow. If it does, it will certainly mean a clan war."
The dwarves behind him muttered among themselves, appearing disconcerted.
"What is your news, though?"
asked Aragorn, worried. The warriors gathered behind Oryk moved aside as he gestured at them, revealing as they did so three bound and bloodied dwarves stacked on top of one another in the corner. The dwarf on the bottom groaned and kicked his feet in the air, but was unable to extricate himself from under his fellow prisoners.
"Who are they?"
asked Aragorn. Oryk replied,
"I heard several of our smiths examine the daggers your attackers carried. They identified the craftsmanship as that of one Kiefner Longnose, a bladesmith of our clan who has achieved great renown among our people."
"So he can tell us who bought the daggers, and thus who our enemies are."
A brusque laugh shook Oryk's chest.
"Hardly, but we were able to track the daggers from Kiefner to an armourer in Dalgon, many leagues from here, who sold them to a Nurlaf with..."
"A Nurlaf?"
Aragorn asked. Oryk scowled.
"A woman! A woman with seven fingers on each hand bought the daggers 2 months ago."
"And did you find her?"
"There can't be very many women with that number of fingers."
"Actually, the condition is fairly common among our people," said Oryk. "Be that as it may, after quite a bit of difficulty we managed to locate the woman in Dalgon. My warriors there questioned her most closely. She is of Durgrimstnagra, but so far as we can determine, she was acting of her own accord, and not under orders from the leaders of her clan. From her we learned that a dwarf had engaged her to buy the daggers, and then to deliver them to a wine merchant who would take them with him from Dalgon. The woman's employer did not tell her where the daggers were destined, but by asking among the merchants of the city, we discovered that he travelled directly from Dalgon to one of the cities held by Durgrimst as Sweldon Rac-Anuin."
"So it was them!"
Aragorn exclaimed.
"That, or it could have been someone who wished us to think it was them. We needed more evidence before we could establish as Sweldon Rac-Anuin's guilt for certain."
A twinkle appeared in Oryk's eyes, and he raised a finger.
"So, by means of a very, very clever spell, we retraced the path of the assassins back through the tunnels and caves and up to a deserted area on the 12th level of Trondheim, off the subadjunct auxiliary hall of the southern spoke in the western quadrant, along the... Ah, well, it does not matter. But some day I will have to teach you how the rooms are arranged in Trondheim, so that if ever you need to find a place within the city by yourself, you can. In any event, the trail led us to an abandoned storeroom, where those three," he gestured toward the bound dwarves, "had been staying. They were not expecting us, and so we were able to capture them alive, although they tried to kill themselves. It was not easy, but we broke the minds of two of them, leaving the third for the other Grimstborathen to interrogate at their pleasure. And we took from them everything they knew about this matter.
Oric pointed at the prisoners again.
It was they who equipped the assassins for the attack, gave them the daggers and their black clothes, and fed and sheltered them last night.
Who are they? Asked Aragorn.
There!
Exclaimed Oric, and spat on the floor.
They are vile, Grimston. Warriors who have disgraced themselves and are now clanless. No one deals with such filth unless they are engaged in villainy themselves and do not wish others to know of it. And so it was with those three. They took their orders directly from Grimstborith Vermund of Aswelden Rak Anuin.
There is no doubt?
Oric shook his head.
There is no doubt. It is Aswelden Rak Anuin who tried to kill you, Aragorn. We will probably never know if any other clans joined them in the attempt. But if we expose Aswelden Rak Anuin's treachery, it will force everyone else who might have been involved in the plot to disparage their former confederates, to abandon, or at least delay, further attacks on Durgrimst in Jetum. And if this is handled properly, to give me their vote for king.
An image flashed in Aragorn's mind, of the prismatic blade emerging from the back of Kvaistor's neck, and of the dwarf's agonized expression as he had fallen to the floor, dying.
How will we punish Aswelden Rak Anuin for this crime? Should we kill Vermund?
Ha ha, leave that to me, said Oric, and tapped the side of his nose. I have a plan. But we must tread carefully, for this is a situation of the utmost delicacy. Such a betrayal has not occurred in many long years. As an outsider, you cannot know how abhorrent we find it that one of our own should attack a guest. You, being the only free rider left to oppose Galbatorix, only worsens the offence. Further bloodshed may yet be necessary. But at the moment, it would only bring about another clan war. A clan war might be the only way to deal with Aswelden Rak Anuin,
Aragorn pointed out.
I think not. But if I am mistaken and war is unavoidable, we must ensure it is a war between the rest of the clans and Aswelden Rak Anuin. That would not be so bad. Together we could crush them inside of a week. A war with the clan split into two or three factions, however, would destroy our country. It is crucial, then, that before we draw our swords, we convince the other clans of what Aswelden Rak Anuin has done. Toward that end, will you allow magicians from different clans to examine your memories of the attack, so they may see it happened as we shall say it did, and that we did not stage it for our own benefit.
Aragorn hesitated, reluctant to open his mind to strangers, then nodded toward the three dwarves stacked on top of one another.
What about them? Won't their memories be enough to convince the clans of Aswelden Rak Anuin's guilt?
Oric grimaced.
They ought to be. But in order to be thorough, the clan chiefs will insist upon verifying their memories against yours. And if you refuse, Aswelden Rak Anuin will claim we are hiding something from the clan meet, and that our accusations are nothing more than slanderous fiction.
Very well, said Aragorn. If I must, I must. But if any of the magicians stray where they are not supposed to, even if by accident, I will have no choice but to burn what they have seen out of their minds. There are some things I cannot allow to become common knowledge. Nodding, Oric said,
Aye, I can think of at least one three-legged piece of information that would cause us some consternation if it were to be trumpeted throughout the land, eh? I am sure the clan chiefs will accept your conditions, for they all have secrets of their own they would not want bandied about. Just as I am sure they will order their magicians to proceed, regardless of the danger. This attack has the potential to incite such turmoil among our race that Grimes Borithin will feel compelled to determine the truth about it, though it may cost them their most skilled spellcasters.
Drawing himself upright then, to the full extent of his limited height, Oric ordered the prisoners removed from the ornate entryway, and dismissed all of his vassals, save for Aragorn, and a contingent of 26 of his finest warriors. With a graceful flourish, Oric grasped Aragorn's left elbow, and conducted him toward the inner rooms of his chambers.
"Tonight you must remain here with me, where Asweldon Rac Arnwen will not dare to strike."
"If you intend to sleep," said Aragorn, "I must warn you I cannot rest, not tonight. My blood still churns from the tumult of the fight, and my thoughts are likewise uneasy."
Oric replied,
"Rest or not, as you will. You shall not disturb my slumber, for I shall pull a thick woolen cap low over my eyes. I urge you to try and calm yourself, however, perhaps with some of the techniques the elves taught you, and recover what strength you may. The new day is already upon us, and but a few hours remain until the clan meet shall be assembled. We should both be as fresh as possible for what is to come. What we do and say today shall determine the ultimate fate of mine people, mine country, and the rest of Alagasia. Oh, do not look so grim about the mouth. Think of this instead. Whether success or failure awaits us, and I surely hope we prevail, our names shall be remembered until the end of time for how we comport ourselves at this clan meet. That at least is an accomplishment to fill your belly with pride. The gods are fickle, and the only immortality we can count on is that which we win through our deeds. Fame or infamy, either one is preferable to being forgotten when you have passed from this realm."
Later that night, in the dead hours before morning, Aragorn's thoughts wandered, as he sat slumped within the embrace of the padded arms of a dwarf couch, and the frame of his consciousness dissolved into the disordered fantasy of his waking dreams. Yet conscious of the mosaic of coloured stones mounted upon the wall opposite him, he also beheld, as if a glowing scrim draped over the mosaic, scenes of his life in Palancar Valley before momentous and bloody fate had intervened in his existence. The scenes diverged from established fact, however, and immersed him in imaginary situations, constructed piecemeal from fragments of what had actually been. In the last few moments before he roused himself from his stupor, his vision flickered, and the images acquired a sense of heightened reality. He was standing in Horst's workshop, the doors of which hung open, loose upon their hinges, like an idiot's slack-jaw grin. Outside was a starless night, and the all-consuming darkness seemed to press against the edges of the dull red light cast by the coals, as if eager to devour everything within the scope of that ruddy sphere. Next to the forge, Horst loomed like a giant, the shifting shadows upon his face and beard fearsome to behold. His burly arm rose and fell, and a bell-like clang shivered the air as the hammer he wielded struck the end of a yellow glowing bar of steel. A burst of sparks extinguished itself on the ground. Four more times the smith smote the metal. Then he lifted the bar from his anvil and plunged it into a barrel of oil. Wraith-like flames, blue and gossamer, flickered across the surface of the oil and then vanished with small shrieks of fury. Removing the bar from the barrel, Horst turned toward Aragorn and frowned at him. He said,
"Why have you come here, Aragorn?"
"I need a dragon rider's sword."
"Be gone with you. I have no time to forge you a rider's sword. Cannot you see I am working on a pothook for Elaine? She must have it for the battle. Are you alone?"
"I do not know,"
Where is your father? Where is your mother?
I do not know. Then a new voice sounded, a well-polished voice of strength and power, and it said,
Good Smith, he is not alone. He came with me. And who might you be? Demanded Horst. I am his father.
Between the gaping doors, a huge figure rimmed with pale light emerged from the clotted darkness and stood upon the threshold of the workshop. A red cape billowed from shoulders wider than a cull's. In the man's left hand gleamed Zarok, sharp as pain. Through the slits of his brightly polished helm, his blue eyes bored into Aragorn, pinning him into place like an arrow through a rabbit. He lifted his free hand and held it out toward Aragorn.
My son, come with me. Together we can destroy the Varden, kill Galbatorix, and conquer all of Alagaesia. But give me your heart, and we shall be invincible. Give me your heart, my son.
With a strangled exclamation, Aragorn leaped out of the couch and stood staring at the floor, his fists clenched, his chest heaving. Oryk's guards gave him inquisitive glances, but he ignored them, too upset to explain his outburst. The hour was still early, so after a time Aragorn settled back onto the couch. But thereafter he remained alert, and did not allow himself to sink into the land of dreams, for fear of what manifestations might torment him. Aragorn stood with his back to the wall, his hand on the pommel of his dwarf sword, as he watched the various clan chiefs file into the round conference room buried beneath Trondheim. He kept an especially close eye on Vermund, the Grimstborith of Asweldon Rac Anuin. But if the purple-veiled dwarf was surprised to see Aragorn alive and well, he did not show it. Aragorn felt Oryk's boot nudge his own. Without looking away from Vermund, Aragorn leaned over toward Oryk and heard him whisper,
Remember, to the left and three doorways down.
Referring to the place where Oryk had stationed 100 of his warriors, without the other clan chiefs knowing. Whispering as well, Aragorn said,
If blood is shed, should I seize the opportunity to kill that snake, Vermund? Unless he is attempting the same with you or me, please do not.
A low chuckle emanated from Oryk.
It would hardly endear you to the other Grimstborithen. Ah, I must go now. Pray to Sindri for luck, would you? We are about to venture into a lava field none have dared cross before.
And Aragorn prayed. When all of the clan chiefs were seated around the table in the center of the room, those watching from the perimeter, including Aragorn, took their own seats from among the ring of chairs set against the curving wall. Aragorn did not relax into his, however, as many of the dwarves did, but sat upon the edge, ready to fight at the slightest hint of danger. As Ganel, the black-eyed warrior priest of Durgrimst Quan, rose from the table and began to speak in dwarvish, Hundfast sidled closer to Aragorn's right side and murmured a continuous translation. The dwarf said,
Greetings again, mine fellow clan chiefs. But whether 'tis well met or not, I am undecided. For certain disturbing rumours, rumours of rumours, if truth be told, have reached mine ears. I have no information beyond these vague and worrisome mutterings, nor proof upon which to found an accusation of misdeeds. However, as today is mine day to preside over this, our congregation, I propose that we delay our most serious debates for the moment, and if you are agreeable, allow me to pose a few questions to the meet.
The clan chiefs muttered among themselves, and then Eorunnan, bright, dimpling Eorunnan, said,
I have no objection, Grimstborith Ganel. You have aroused mine curiosity with these cryptic insinuations. Let us hear what questions you have.
Aye, let us hear them, said Nardo.
Let us hear them, agreed Mandrath,
and all the rest of the clan chiefs,
including Vermund. Having received the permission he sought, Ganel rested his knuckles upon the table and was silent for a span.